Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for the weekend edition. Also, as always, your hosts on our website and podcast throughout the week, recording daily editorials and company updates. On this weekend show, we're going to be sticking to broadly the resource sector. We're kicking off the show with a couple fund managers more focused on the metals area. And then in the second half of the show, we're transitioning over to energy. I hope you all enjoy this show. And as always, please keep in touch with Shad and I through email. We're kicking off this show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, last time we talked, about a month ago, you had mentioned that the portfolio that you manage at MJG, it was a slower year in terms of transactions. I think you said you had two larger transactions in the second half of the year, which is a bit on the low side, but also speaks to the market. Now that we've gone through a little bit of a bump, especially in precious metals, but even some of the base metals have moved higher. Have you changed any of your strategy for the tail end of this year? And what's your outlook for next year in terms of transactions within the fund? Do you think it's going to pick up?
Thanks for having me back on the program here, Corey. Always good to join you and Shad. I would say, in short, it's been more of the same from an MJG perspective. We've only made two new investments in the second half of this year, one on the open market and one via a private placement. I think I mentioned that name on our last call. That was Ridgeline Minerals' most recent placement and our first entry into that story. Not anticipating anything new being added to the portfolio before the end of the year here. But of course, 2023 is fast approaching. You know, at this point, we've really been using a one in, one out strategy. So if I'm considering adding a new name, I certainly want to exit at least one of our existing positions just to keep the portfolio at a manageable size. I think we're at 19 or 20 names as it stands. I'd like to get as low as 15 names. That can be difficult to do with so many opportunities out there. You know, my sense is for the resource and mining markets generally, I'm quite cautious and I remain quite cautious. I think we're going to be at the whims of the broader market for the foreseeable future here. And I'm just looking back 12 months ago to the euphoria that was evident in the marketplace, the elevated valuations across many different asset classes, and of course, the broadly supportive fiscal and monetary support from the Fed and U.S. government in 2020 and 2021. And I may be wrong. We may have seen the bottom already, but my sense is that, you know, the confluence of those three factors and kind of the fever pitch we reached just late last year means that there's more pain ahead. So I do think we see more risk off pain ahead for the broader markets. I think the mining equities will be affected, even if it's at no fault of their own. If there's one caveat, I do think that it's possible and maybe likely, based off of the moves over the past few weeks, that precious metals in particular have bottomed. So I'm thinking primarily of gold and silver. When I say bottomed, that does not mean that we're off to the races with a 2016-like scenario. That's possible. But when I say bottom, we can still have sharp drawdowns, sharp pullbacks, especially if we see the U.S. dollar continue its meteoric rise. But I think the lows have likely been put in. That doesn't rule out us retesting those lows. But for gold and silver in particular, I'm feeling a little bit more constructive. And the reason for that is that we've already had 2+ years of pain. And so all but the strongest hands are remaining equities. Whereas if you look at the rest of the metals complex, I mean, as recently as 6 or 7 months ago in the immediate aftermath of the Ukraine invasion by Russia, we saw the rest of the metals complex rocking and rolling really across the board. And, you know, strength in some metals, including lithium, have continued even to this day. So I do think there is more pain ahead for most of the rest of the metals complex. Precious metals may be an exception.
Yeah, Matt, that's an interesting observation because you're right. After the Ukraine war escalation, we saw big moves in most of the base metals And we did see some moves in the precious metals that quickly sold off, but it does appear, and you're not alone in thinking that maybe we have seen at least a floor put in the precious metals. Doesn't mean, like you say, it's off to the races, but at least constructive that maybe some of the downside pain is over after 2 years of investors struggling. But one thing we were discussing before this call was the financing window and the financing environment. And it seems to be a tale of the haves and the have-nots. There are certain companies that are able to attract capital and good partners, and they're able to upsize their financing, while the vast majority of companies are still struggling to get capital to fund their work programs this year. What do you make of the current financing environment, Matt?
Personally, I like these types of market environments. I mean, I think that's the way the junior space should operate. Whenever you're looking at a number of names, you should assume that 80% of them do not deserve a place in your portfolio, at least if not a much higher rejection rate. In environments where, you know, all companies, good, bad, and ugly, are able to raise capital at advantageous terms, as an investor, that probably means it's a better environment to be selling or, you know, taking profits, or at the very least sitting on your hands. So I think the self-selection by the market is a good thing. That might be bitter medicine for some companies out there that are struggling to raise money. But like you said, for the right story, a lot of these companies already have cash in the bank as well. But for the right story, there is access to capital available. And I think any company, even if they already have a decent cash buffer that's raising in this window here, is making a prudent decision. Again, as I mentioned in my previous answer, I think, you know, odds are that there's more pain ahead. And I think folks that raise in this window, looking back from late 2023, this will look like a smart decision. You saw plenty of these deals or plenty of similar deals earlier this year in the spring. And there's a lot of head scratching, by investors, and some anger that management teams diluted. In hindsight, any groups that took money when available in the spring look quite smart. So I think that's going to be a similar situation here. I mean, a couple deals that come to mind would be the Banyan Gold's pretty hefty financing announced just today. I think they're going for $12.5 million. They raised just a few months ago. But again, I think Terra's making a good decision there by coming back to market and cashing up. Of course, the big news was the Lundin family's investment into Fireweed Metals just last week. I was actually at the Mines and Money London conference and went out to drinks on the day of the announcement. So I'm personally thrilled for him and the team at Fireweed. I went and visited that project back in 2019 with him and John Robbins and some other investors as part of the Yukon Mining Alliance tour. It's not been a position of ours, but I admire the dedication of that team, and particularly Brandon remaining razor focused on this one opportunity, not getting distracted with other vehicles. And, you know, they've been rewarded here with a healthy, in a $35 million investment from the Lundin family. This is really the first major deal that they've done since Lucas passed. And interestingly, the Lundins don't do all too many deals in North America. They like going out to foreign frontiers and investing in, you know, less geopolitically stable jurisdictions. Thinking back, probably the last investments they've made in Canada was maybe into the Pine Point project in Northwest Territories, you know, back 5 years ago. Of course, they made good money with Pretium a little bit longer than that. So it's actually not all too common to see them deploying cash in North America. I think it's a great endorsement of the Fireweed Metal story. And they're going to be able to churn out 20,000 meters next year, if I'm not mistaken. So I think there's a lot of good news flow to come there. And the company has cash to last into 2024, which I think is an enviable position.
There has been a lot of encouraging financings here that cash up companies. In all fairness, a lot of these companies, as Shad said, that already have money. It is interesting for Fireweed Metals to see that investment come in, and it ties into a bigger picture, I guess, narrative that has been on investors' minds here, where Yukon, that area generally seems to be getting a lot more attention. We've seen great drill results out of Yukon, even out of northern Canada and into Alaska. The money has flowed a bit more into some of these stocks. Now, one thing we do need to consider is it is very expensive to drill, to do any work up in northern Canada and Alaska. Plus, it seems like some of the, development does take a while longer up there as well. So again, you need to raise a lot of money to spend a lot of money up in these jurisdictions, but they are getting attention. What do you take away from this environment, Matt, where the Yukon and other northern areas, northern provinces and states, they're getting a lot more attention than anywhere else?
They are. Yeah, I mean, the Yukon's a fascinating jurisdiction. But as you said, whether you look at, you know, Western Copper and what they're doing at the casino project with Rio, who's just extended their kind of trial period here for another year. So around this time next year, Rio will have to make a decision on whether to push forward with the JV, potentially take Western Copper and Gold out, or walk away and focus on other opportunities. But I think that's good for the Yukon at large. You know, we've seen a lot of excitement around Snowline over the past few months, and what's been a pretty exciting discovery, not too far away actually from Fireweed Metals, and then of course, you know, the Lundin family's investment into Fireweed was the latest domino to drop. Plenty of attractive aspects to the Yukon. It has a relatively rich mining history, immense geological potential, and it's a stable jurisdiction as well. And even though there's a liberal government in charge there, they're relatively supportive of at least the right mining properties. Challenges, as you mentioned, include the expense of operating up there. Also, accessibility can be an issue. Unless you want to really spend through the nose, you're going to have to work, you know, a limited months of the year. Infrastructure is an issue. If you find a deposit that's potentially worth building, and there are also, you know, First Nations relations that need to be taken seriously, really from the beginning of development. So, you know, there's pros and cons, as there are with any major jurisdiction. I guess if there's one thing that I would caution listeners that are maybe, you know, new to investing in the Yukon or some of these northern jurisdictions, or that there's typically a pretty big news flow gap really between, we'll say, late February into the summer. So a lot of these companies are churning or pumping out their drill results as we speak. And so there's probably going to be continued excitement here for another 4 to 8 weeks. But for the properties that aren't able to operate year round, which I would say are the majority of them, there's going to be a gap. So even if you've got your eyes on an interesting project with a good management team trading at a decent valuation, maybe give some thought to, you know, holding off on initiating a position until this lull in news flow, and maybe take a closer look in, you know, April or May rather than jumping in after the latest news release. Or at the very least, maybe you can average in over the next 6 months rather than initiating your entire position today. So I think especially for these stories where you can't operate year round, kind of getting a finger on the pulse of news flow is important, at least for timing your buy and sell decisions.
Matt, just as I was listening to you, this brings up an interesting concept in that the normal seasonality patterns that we saw out of different jurisdictions, it's not just Yukon, but it could be the Golden Triangle or other areas, or some areas have rainy seasons at off times, you know, if in their southern hemisphere, they may be contrasting to North American properties. But almost every company across the board has all these drill results that they're sitting on at labs that sometimes are taking 2 to 4 months to get released. So as a result, the normal seasonality patterns are all over the map now. Even in areas that you mentioned that usually go quiet, they may be sitting on 2/3 of their drill results. So do you think that as we turn the calendar over into the what's seasonably a good time for the precious metals, or even sometimes the base metals, that maybe these drill results being delayed was a good thing for the whole industry, and maybe they'll start becoming reasons to buy stocks as opposed to reasons to liquidate stocks?
Yeah, well, that's a good glass half full perspective, Shad. I think there may be some merit to that, where companies can plausibly delay their results further into the new year than they would have otherwise, because there are legitimate backups, you know, 2 to 3 months, as you said, in assay labs in BC in particular, and in other jurisdictions around the world, especially as, you know, mining markets have softened over the last, 6 months or so. We see assay turnarounds of maybe 8 weeks, and some folks are saying they may drop even to 4 weeks in the new year. But particularly up in you know, BC, where you have core coming down from the Northern Triangle, the Golden Triangle, coming down from the Yukon, we are seeing these long delays. And yeah, companies can credibly that, hey, there's nothing wrong with the results. We're anticipating them, but they're just being held up. Whereas in a usual market environment where you don't have this, you know, mad rush for drilling assays, a delay in results is almost never a good thing. In this case, it's an exception.
All right, let's switch focus just a little bit quickly and talk about copper. Because recently, when you're in Europe, you spoke on a copper panel. What's your outlook on copper?
So I am a copper bull. I am biased towards copper, but as we've talked about plenty of times before, I do my best to put aside my affinity for copper when evaluating new opportunities and looking at them through the lens of spot metal prices. So I'll include that caveat. That said, copper is an essential metal in the ongoing decarbonization push globally. It's really the veins and artery of electricity taking it from point A to point B. It is also much more important in terms of generating power than hydrocarbon means. You know, per unit of electricity for a wind turbine, there's between 6 to 17x more copper used per unit of electricity versus, you know, typical hydrocarbon sources. That's a bit of a wide range there, mind you, but that's the difference between onshore and off, which is much more copper intensive. That said, you know, going back to my answer earlier in this discussion, copper as well will be at the whims, I believe, of the broader stock market. So in my mind, we could totally see a scenario of $2.50 copper a year from now and $6 to $7 copper 4 years from now. So I'm able to hold both of those views in mind, where over the medium to long term, I think that's, of course, you have to still select your investments wisely, but you know, this is a metal that's going to have the wind at its back for at least the rest of this next decade. That said, if there's a major global recession, copper and, you know, these other more sexy batteries simply will not be spared. So I'm cautious, and it will say over the 6 to 12 months, but copper remains, you know, a core exposure within the MJG portfolio. Aside from gold, we have no greater exposure to any other metal.
Well, Matt, I think a lot of people share that interest in copper. And when we talk to precious metals bulls, they often say the only other metal that they want to touch is copper. But when you look at investing in the copper mining space, there are the behemoths that need huge billion-dollar capital capex to build their projects if they're in development, or even if they're developing another mine as a producer. Then there's those smaller players that don't have as much capex because they're higher-grade copper deposits. That's kind of what we see in Canada sometimes, more so than what you would see down in South America. But there are some projects like that in the U.S. as well, in Nevada and Arizona, New Mexico. And then there's the exploration companies that are out there drilling for more copper. Out of those three segments, which ones as a company would catch your eye more?
Well, the answer is actually none of them. The majority of our copper exposure comes through either prospect generators or royalty names, namely Nova Royalty, which is a fully copper-focused company, but also copper exposure through EMX and Elemental Altus, as their new name goes, with exposure to the Caserones producing copper mine down in Chile, amongst other copper-focused assets. So I think there's many different ways to invest in the metal. I don't think it's one size fits all. And I think there's ways to make money with producers. There's ways to lose money with producers. There's ways to make money with exploration stage plays. There's ways to lose money. So it's really about security selection and also investors knowing what, you know, business models and what strategies work for them. But as you know, the MJG fund, at this point, close to 50% of our weighted portfolio is either prospect generation or royalty names. And that's not different for our copper exposure.
All right, Matt, we're going to wrap it up here. We are out of time for this segment. Always great chatting with you, buddy. I love hearing how you're playing these markets, really on a slightly more conservative nature right now because of the outlook for, well, what we're seeing in terms of the markets. And you're right, just how tied to the broad averages the metals can be. So, Matt, we're going to have you back on next month. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. And hey, have a great rest of your weekend. Thank you again for your comments.
Thank you both. Happy New Year.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.